Hi everyone, welcome to Behind the Numbers. My name is Dave Bookbinder and we are coming to you live from the RBN Television Studios. This guy to my right is Seth Broder. He's the president of Broder Law and we're going to be having a great conversation about helping business owners. Seth, welcome Behind the Numbers.
David, so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your firm, and then we'll jump in.
Sure. So I've had the pleasure of being an attorney in this state and Pennsylvania for, almost 30 years now. And I have a small firm in Morristown, New Jersey. And we really specialize in representing small businesses. And when I say small business, could be anywhere from a couple hundred thousand dollars a year in revenue to $10-20 million in revenue. I like to say that we are the general counsel to these businesses.
Yep. And what you're seeing day to day is going to be so valuable to share with the audience. So I'm going to start at the top, if you don't mind. Business formation. Somebody's contemplating starting the business. Maybe they've got a partner. Maybe it's a solopreneur. What's the best way to do that?
So number one is to sit down and meet with the client or clients. Sometimes I laugh because somebody will sit down and they'll say, hey, I want to form a business in Delaware or Nevada. I was told I have to do that. And you understand why they're saying that. But
tell the audience why that is.
Yeah, so number one, these are states that have very friendly laws towards businesses, and especially taxation issues. What I explain to them is that's not necessarily necessary because they're doing fix and flips of homes or whatever they're doing. The most important thing is, number one, unlimited liability, right? You want that liability protection. And then after that, you want to take advantage of whatever tax benefits that you can get from being the particular entity. If you're asking, what are the popular entities these days? I can tell you that I can't tell you the last time I formed a C corporation. Just doesn't seem like it's really a practical thing to do for what I do and what I see. Do a lot of limited liability companies, lot of S corps and partnerships.
Yeah, and within those structures, there's something called an operating agreement that's kind of a big deal. And I've seen some clients recently that are playing, I'll call it fast and loose with the operating agreements.
Yeah, it's huge. Dave, here's how I describe the operating agreement. And I want to be very clear to you, and I'm very clear to my clients, I do not under any circumstance practice family law. I wouldn't know how to do it. I think it's hard enough to stay married in today's climate. Kidding. But what I do explain to them by way of analogy is that right now you two really get along and you're excited and you are forming this business and you have all these great ideas of what you're going to do. Someday, and I hope it never happens, someday you might not be in love like you are right now. So what we have to decide now why you are is how we are going to divvy up the kids. How are you going to split up the assets? How are you going to value those assets? What is the formula? Who's going to do what? Who's allowed to do what? And I think that it is so important to have that in an agreement from day one, because I'm telling you, I've seen it where, frankly, I see it often, where people don't have an agreement. And then what happens? It ends up in litigation.
Yeah, and in my world, the operating agreement drives a lot of valuation considerations. It'll outline things like the order in which someone is compensated in terms of distributions, whether there's dividends, what have you, and in the event of a liquidation of the business. And there's so many reasons why it's imperative that that be in place. And you mentioned something about valuing the assets. And is that inside the operating agreement, Seth, or are you now alluding to something more of a buy-sell agreement?
No, that would be, a buy-sell provision would be in the agreement. And again, we're talking, with an LLC, an operating agreement, yeah, or a member agreement, and with a corporation, shareholder agreement. It's really just how they're termed, but it's the same concept. And what you're referring to, David, is really what we'll call a triggering event, right? So let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Let's say you and I are in business together, whatever it is that we're doing.
It sounds like fun.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And something happens to one of us that causes a triggering event. Let's say either disability, death, divorce, bankruptcy. Those things could happen. And Dave, you might have the sweetest wife in the world. And we go out socially, we have a lot of fun together, but I just don't think I want to be in business with your wife selling our blue widgets. And conversely, you don't want to be in business with my wife. So if in a situation like that, something, God forbid, should happen to one of us, the other one knows, okay, here's how we're going to value your shares, your membership interest, if it's an LLC, and we are going to determine that value based on an agreed upon formula, and we have outside accountants, someone like you, David, that can determine the value, and we then have the payment provision, whether it be a lump sum, which is funded by, let's say, life insurance,
yeah,
or we do it over time, which is really more common with a note and agreed upon interest rate, maybe tied into prime and an amount of time.
Yeah, if I could just weigh in on the buy-sell agreement,
because
I've seen that movie quite a bit, and I want to offer maybe a public service announcement to some of the folks who are listening and watching out there. I've seen formulas in the buy-sell agreements. One is where they talk about, we agree that the value of the business is equal to the book value. Wrong. Book value and fair market value are always going to be different. Then I see we're going to try and get a little more fancy about it, and we'll agree that the business is worth, pick a number, 6x EBITDA. That's also problematic because, first of all, you've got to define what EBITDA is, and there's often a lot of add backs when you're talking about smaller businesses. And the multiple, you know, a lot of it's just derived because somebody's brother-in-law told them about it at a cocktail party. That multiple may be right in that moment, but markets move and multiples change. Right. And multiple selections based on so many factors. So the public service announcement piece is, I would recommend putting in a language that talks about using an independent valuation professional to value the business when you need it.
That's great. I mean, what we typically do is when we're doing those agreements, you know, I know what I know, and I certainly know what I don't know. So when it comes to an issue of how we're going to evaluate it, I would defer to, like you said, an outside person or the company accountant to at least come up with a viable formula that everyone agrees to.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
In the moment, exactly.
In the moment, absolutely. But, yeah. I think, again, the key is that if you do that while everyone gets along,
oh yeah,
it's so much easier than trying to piece things together in the event that things really go south. Whether they went south because of a personality issue, of a market issue, or because, like I said, someone who was disabled or, God forbid, died.
Yeah, and it happens. I see it all the time.
Yeah.
You get the unwanted business partner because somebody passes away or they become incapacitated, and it goes to the spouse, in your example, yeah, and now you're in partnership with somebody you never envisioned being in business with.
And I'm dealing with this issue right now, actually, where the clients have a small business in South Jersey, and it's a good business, but I wouldn't say it's a business that is an amazing business, but regardless, the one of the partners died, and the spouse, the wife, says to me, I'm told and I understand that this is going to be about $1 million coming to me. And it's not even close. So you have to explain, here's the valuation. Yeah. The accountant has provided all the financials. It's not even in the right ballpark. And that's only because maybe husband was telling wife how great business was, but also there was no agreement. Yeah. So there's not even a formula.
Yeah, and maybe even more often than not, husband and wife aren't really talking about the business. And now the spouse comes in uninformed, unaware, and maybe doesn't have an interest in it, and maybe can compel a sale. And there's all kinds of problems around that.
Yeah, well, that's certainly, you know, one of the remedies that are available. And you want to avoid that. Look, I always say, no matter what I'm doing, there's always an amicable solution. Right?
Yeah, yeah. And to your point, do it early, do it up front while everybody's still getting along.
It's so smart.
Yeah.
It's so smart to do that.
Seth, for folks who want to learn more about you, how they can get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do
sure.
that?
Sure. So our phone number is 856-234-8768. I am at sbroder@broderlawgroup.com. And that is the same website as well, broderlawgroup.com.
Awesome. Thank you. Just got word that we're getting close to commercial break, but rather than start something here, we're going to pause now. So sit tight, Seth. Folks watching and listening, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on Behind the Numbers after this quick break.
Explore. Enjoy. Experience Mercer County. Picture yourself here. Explore, enjoy, experience Mercer County. Picture yourself here. Explore, enjoy, experience Mercer County.
Center shot again. Three,
yes, sir.
2, 1.
And welcome back to Behind the Numbers. I'm Dave Bookbinder, and this is Seth Broder from Broder Law. Seth, welcome back. It goes fast here, I know. But I want to continue on in talking to the privately held business owners. And are you representing companies in sale transactions?
Absolutely. So again, let's go back to the example of two people coming to my office saying, we want to form a business. This is what we want to do. What do we do? So after the formation of the entity, and again, we're going to really hammer home the importance of having that buy-sell agreement or some kind of agreement in place. Then they're off to the races. So they say, all right, well, things are going really well, and thank you for representing us with regard to this lease. We now want to buy that building over there. So I will represent them in every step of the way till they get to closing for the purchase of that building. And then they say, we want to bring in tenants. Okay, I will handle that part. And then they say, you know what? We want to bring in a partner because this partner brings X to the table. So I will then do that transaction. And next thing you know, the kids are taking over the business. So there's succession planning. Yeah. And I work with my partner and we do a lot of the estate planning and whatnot. And then at the end of the day, there's the sale of the business. And that's really a great thing because you can see all the work that has gone into that particular business for all these years. And you know, with the amount of time I've been practicing, I'm seeing that life cycle now,
yeah,
which is great. And yeah, we do everything with regard to the sale of the business
so
as well.
So in the sale transaction, one of the things that we see a lot is something that I'll call the valuation gap. What the buyer is willing to pay, what the seller wants to receive, and one of the convenient ways to bridge that valuation gap is earnout. Talk a little bit about some of the nuances, yeah, around earnout provisions.
That's a great question. And I'm actually dealing with it right now in a transaction. And this is somewhat of a, I don't want to say negative or jaded view, but I always say to clients that are selling a business, whether it's real estate only, whether it's their business of selling widgets, whatever it is, I always say, whatever you're going to get at closing, if you're going to hold a note, if you're going to have some sort of earnout or whatnot, just assume worst case scenario that all you're going to get is what you're getting at closing. And I know it's a bit of a jaded view on it, but I've seen it too many times that it's, yeah, happened, because a lot of times there's a fallout. There's a fall down, if you will, from business owner A selling it to business owner B, because A has all the contacts and the goodwill and whatnot, yeah, with the clients of the particular business. So a smart thing to do if you're buying the business is ensure that person A is staying on at least for, you know, a few years or whatnot, just to really cement that transition. But I do see that earn out. And what I do from an attorney representing the seller is I try my best to make sure that earn out, that those payments are secured by something, whether it be a mortgage, obviously a UCC, something to lessen the chance that business owner who's worked so hard will get all of the money at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I don't want to make any assumptions that everyone who's viewing this program understands the earnout discussion, but that really is formula-based. A lot of times, earnouts are going to be based upon getting additional consideration for the business based upon achieving certain financial thresholds, whether it's revenue, whether it's net income, EBITDA, and so forth. How are you helping your clients and protecting them and making sure that those formulas are, you know, mutually advantageous, let's say?
Well, again, if it's if from the seller's perspective, the one I'm dealing with right now, there's an earnout provision that is tied into revenue, so top line, and EBITDA. And the concern we have from the seller perspective is that the new co that comes in and buys, well, they can really control the EBITDA because they might say, you know what, I want to hire that position for $200,000, that position for $150,000, and now all of a sudden your EBITDA is completely affected. So what we do is we put a cap on things. We put a cap on spending, or we have it where it's a voting process. There's the ability to turn down depending on the business judgment.
Yeah.
So there's things you can do to try to minimize that risk.
Yeah, and I like what you said, and I think that's worth repeating because a lot of business owners sometimes maybe get greedy, we'll call it, because they want the second bite of the apple. Sometimes you know it's a psychological component because they're not willing to let go. But the idea that you're going to get that second bite, and I think you said it, assume that you're not going to get anything more than the initial consideration and work from that.
Yeah, that's the premise I work from. And again, it's somewhat of a jaded view, but
I'll call it pragmatic.
It's pragmatic.
Because I've seen that too with earnouts, whether it's EBITDA provision or rolling over equity into the new co and then watching it disappear.
Yeah, good.
So it sounds good up front, but doesn't always work out that way. So
Hope it does.
Protect your downside, and that's what you're for.
I try to.
Yes. Yeah. I want to shift gears to intellectual property. If you looked at the S&P 500 in 1975, intellectual property, I believe, was about 10% of total market value. You look at it currently, and it's about 90% of market value. So intellectual property is critical, especially when you're talking about smaller businesses. Talk a little bit about intellectual property and some of the protection provisions you're able to offer clients.
Sure. So number one, whenever I have a client that has a business with something that would be protectable, I always want to make sure that protection is in place, i.e., patent protection, trademark protection, whatnot. I am not specifically an IP attorney, and that's its own sort of subset, its own niche. It's actually, even as a patent attorney, you have to have a certain bar for that. Okay. But I work with intellectual property attorneys, depending on what my client's business is. And in terms of a sale, that is something, you know, where you can do assignments of patents, there's certainly a lot of NDAs, there's confidentiality, there's non-competes. That stuff is really done at a high level because depending on the business, the IP might be the business itself.
Right.
So that's super important.
Yeah. Seth, for anybody who wants to learn more about you or if they want to work with you, talk to you, what's the best way for them to
do that? Sure. Again, the best way to get in touch with me is either by phone, 856-234-8768. Or if you would like to email me, sbroder@broderlawgroup.com, and the website is broderlawgroup.com.
Thank you. Let's continue on this thread here and talk about funding private deals. What's that like these days?
Funding for private deals is up significantly. And in particular, we're talking about, we'll call it bridge financing. And why is that? Well, I think, and I don't have to tell you this, banks are less thrilled about doing deals. Money costs a lot, and the equity markets have really reduced somewhat. So I'm seeing a ton of private bridge financing. I mean, a lot. And when I say bridge financing, 1 to 2 years, interest only, a higher interest than you would see from a conventional bank. Perhaps even points, lender points that would be involved in that. And it's really a good thing. I know it's like, oh, well, these are loan sharking rates, but not really. No, this is more about I can't get financing or I can't get financing quickly enough. And this is such a great opportunity over here. So I know that the cost to purchase this is going to be built in to the plan.
Yeah.
And after 1 year, of making all the payments, perhaps 2 years, you try to refi out at a more conventional rate.
Yeah, and just to help clarify, these types of loans, the bridge financing you're talking about, are they for the borrower who can't get a traditional finance, the kind of the subprime borrower, if you will?
Yeah, that's somewhat of a bad word.
I grew up in that space.
I'm sure. So, yes, it's someone that either has something on their financial record, you know, whether it be a bankruptcy, something like that, that would cause a bank to not want to do a deal.
Yeah, or they may not have W-2 income.
Or they don't have W-2 income. Or again, like I said in my example, they just need the money too fast than what a bank can operate.
Yeah. What kind of covenants and collateral provisions do you see in these situations?
So I'm only seeing commercial hard money bridge financing deals. And the reason for that, David, is because the laws, and it's a good thing, are so strict in terms of interest rates that you can charge, you know, no higher than if it's a consumer loan or residential loan. I need money to pay for my kid's wedding. I need money to go pay for my kids to go to college. I need money to buy a personal residence. That's not the deals that I'm seeing, and I really don't do any of that, and I haven't. The deals I'm seeing are commercial only. So the covenants, for the most part, my clients that are doing these deals, you have to be within a 50 to 60% LTV, which is loan-to-value ratio. And you really have to have an exit strategy. Meaning, okay, so you have the collateral for it. You check out. You know, there's nothing on the internet or searches that we've seen that makes you a guy that would not be a desirable borrower. But the question is, what is your exit strategy? Because remember, these deals are interest only, and they're 1 to 2 year deals. How are you going to take out this lender who wants this money back? Why? To turn it again to make more interest. I mean, remember, from these private lenders, this is an investment vehicle.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
This is passive income for the most part. You know, their cost of money is here. They're loaning it out at here. And, you know, I understand now in the market, you can get, you know, T-bills and whatnot at 5-6%. But when you're charging 13-15%, it's a nice spread.
Oh, yeah.
And so they want the principal back.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. And so what's the exit strategy?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So are you finding that they can actually sort of, I don't want to say compel, but maybe persuade a business owner to start thinking about the end game sooner than they otherwise would?
Yeah. And, you know, in the deals that I see, there's brokers. There's a network of brokers that do these deals. And they're wise enough to know that when they make the deal, that's kind of the easy part.
Yeah.
The hard part is, again, the second bite of the apple.
Yeah.
I need to get this borrower out in a certain time, and I need to get this borrower out by way of conventional lending.
Okay.
So you work together.
Okay.
And again, the lenders that I do business with, really, when I tell you, they don't want your property. People say, oh, wow, 50% LTV.
Right.
That's great. You're going to foreclose. You're going to make money when you sell it. And the bottom line is they don't want the property. All they want is the interest paid and their principal back so they can do the next loan.
Yeah, get made whole, earn a reasonable spread on it, commensurate with the risk, and move on.
That's exactly right. And my point is, they will work with the borrowers. They will say, okay, look, I know one borrower we're dealing with, it's a seasonal business. So they're a business that's down at the Jersey Shore, and they have 15 weeks to make all their money. So during this time period, they're paying X. But when they're not in this time period, so in the fall and the winter, their payment drops. And that's an agreement with the lender,
yeah,
which I think is a good thing. There's a lot of flexibility. Banks won't do that.
Right. Seth, we're down to the short strokes here, only a few minutes to go, but I want to give you an opportunity to talk about another part of your practice that I think, I'll say, the parents in the audience may appreciate hearing.
Sure.
And that's your special education practice.
Yeah, that's great. So, David, that when I first got out of law school in 1996,
I hope this episode ages well.
It does. I hope so. I worked for a boutique law firm, and all that firm did was special education law, guardianships, and estate planning for families with disabilities. I didn't know anything about the area. But P.S., now almost 30 years later, that is still a niche of mine. I think it's great work. It's challenging work. It's rewarding work. But it really is, for me, a nice balance that I could do that stuff and also work on all of the corporate and real estate work that I do as well. And it's great. It's rewarding.
What's the typical example of something you make your work?
Quickly, a typical example would be a parent has an autistic child in a school district, and they believe the district is not providing that child with what the law requires to be a free and appropriate public education. FAPE is the acronym. So that's the dispute over what is appropriate. And it depends. The child might need more services, might need an out-of-district placement, might need a one-on-one aid, whatever it might be. I will come in and advocate for that particular family.
Okay. Yeah. In like about 60 seconds that we have left here, I want to give you the final word to offer any advice or wisdom for business owners in terms of things that you're seeing where business owners are going wrong, things that they should do differently, things they should do better.
Yeah, I think as we talked about before, the most important aspect of a business and the success of that business is to, I don't know, I hate saying this, but it's so true, have everything buttoned up.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what that means, but what I assume it means is, like I said, have your agreements with your partner or partners. That's the most important thing. Because you want to plan for the time in which things aren't so great. And we talked about that. So have agreements, and not only between the partners, but have agreements with your customers. Make sure that your agreements, like, comport with law. I represent so many contractors that do work at people's homes, and they didn't realize that there's the New Jersey Consumer Fraud Act, which gives you very little room for error. So you want to have things in writing. You want to have the right provisions, the right size font, the reference to your insurance. That all has to be in your agreement. So bottom line is, have agreements.
Yeah. If it's not buttoned up, as you say, then it's going to be open to speculation and conjecture, and that only leads to trouble.
We don't like speculation or conjecture.
No, we don't. We'll do another episode on that another time. Hope you'll come back on.
I would love to. Thank you so much
for having
me.
We are out of time, unfortunately, but I really do appreciate
you. This went fast.
Yes, it did. He is Seth Broder. He is the president of Broder Law. Definitely check them out. My name is Dave Bookbinder, and I'm the one that my clients turn to when they want to know what their most important assets are worth. So if you're like many business owners that don't know the true value of your business, we should have a conversation. So definitely hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm always happy to chat. I want to thank the Big Cheese for running the board today. Great job over there, as he always does. And thank you for watching and listening. Really appreciate your supporting this program. We'll see you next time on Behind the Numbers. Take care, everybody.
Down.
We're out.
Great job.
You too, brother.
Yeah, that was fun. A lot of fun.
That was fun. Awesome. I hope you enjoyed this.
No, it was great. It was great.
You got to talk.